Today we're reading from the 12th canto, chapter 10, text number 8. Sutta uvacha iti uktva tam upyeya Bhagavan sasatam gati Ishanar sarvavidyana Ishvara sarvadevina Sutta uvacha. Sri Sutta Goswami said, iti, thus, uktva, having said, tam, to the sage, upeyaya, going, Bhagavan, the exalted demigod, sa, he, satam, of the pure souls, gati, the shelter, Ishana, the master, Sarvavidyana, of all branches of knowledge, Ishvara, the controller, Sarvadehina, of all embodied living beings. Translation, Sri Sutta Goswami said, having spoken thus, Lord Shankarshan, the shelter of pure soul, master of all spiritual sciences, and controller of all embodied living beings, approached the sage. So this verse doesn't have a purport, so I'll continue on with the verses. Text 9. Because Markandeya's material mind had stopped functioning, the sage failed to notice that Lord Shiva and his wife, the controllers of the universe, had personally come to see him. Markandeya was so absorbed in meditation that he was unaware of either himself or the external world. Managing the situation very well, the powerful Lord Shiva employed his mystic powers to enter within the sky of Markandeya's heart, just as the wind passes through an opening. So this is very extraordinary that Lord Shiva could enter into the sky of his heart. So he was sitting there, he was so intensely focused on his meditation that he had no idea that Lord Shiva was there. And interestingly enough, various personalities who have been in this situation where they were deeply in a trance and they were unaware of the presence of some important personality have actually got themselves into trouble for that, where that person has become angry with them. Can you think of an example? Yes.
Yeah.
Rupa Goswami, yes. And the other one? Yes, Parikshit Maharaj. So these are a couple of examples. So I think there's another one with Indradyumna, who became Gajendra. I think he also was meditating and the sage came. And of course it was the other way around. The king was meditating and the sage was superior, but actually here also Lord Shiva is in a superior position. But Lord Shiva understood Markandeya's mind. So why do you think that Lord Shiva understood Markandeya so well? Because he's a pure devotee. It's also said that the story of Markandeya, his long lifespan is given in one of the Puranas, and it explains that Markandeya was the son of a sage called Markandru and his wife Meridvati, and that the sage was praying to Lord Shiva for a benediction, and Lord Shiva appeared to him and asked him what he wanted. He said he wanted a son. So he asked him, would you like a son who lives a very long life, who lives and lives and lives, or would you like a son who is extraordinarily qualified, but he may live a short life? Sages are very tricky, aren't they? But, yes, sages are very tricky. So this Markendra, he actually, I think it was Lord Shiva who approached him, and he suggested that he would prefer to have a son who was highly extraordinarily qualified but lived a short life. So his son Markandeya was born of his wife, and he was destined to live 16 years. And at 16 years of age, he would die. So in Jagannath Puri, one of the four major Shiva lingams is by the side of a kund called Markandeya Kund, which is to the left-hand side of the Jagannath temple, in a little slightly remote kind of a place. It's not a very commonly visited place except by the pandas who take their tourist groups there. But I don't think the devotees go there very often. And there is a Shiva lingam, and it is said that Markandeya was worshipping Lord Shiva. And when the time came for Yamaraj to come and take him away, he became 16, and he saw Yamaraj coming with a noose to capture him and take him, finish his life. He held on to the Shiva lingam so tightly. He held on. And he was so tightly embracing the Shiva lingam that the noose of Yamaraj, when he threw his noose, he also went around the Shiva lingam as well as Markandeya. And Markandeya was holding on. And then Lord Shiva appeared from the Shiva lingam and said, "What? What are you doing putting your noose of birth and death around me?" And so then he cursed Yama, or time. He said, "You are finished. There will be no more time, no more death." So he cursed him. And then he gave a boon to Markandeya, who is just this young 16-year-old, very pure young boy. And he told him that because of this, you will now live forever, because he had gotten rid of Yamaraj. And then after he had received that blessing, the devas came, and they of course prayed on behalf of Yamaraj to Lord Shiva, and he reduced his punishment of Yamaraj, because they said there has to be death. What will happen if there's no death? Everything won't work properly. So he again was reinstated. But Markandeya, as a young boy, was very specially close to Lord Shiva. And he wrote something called the Markandeya Purana. And in that Purana, it's the shortest of all the Puranas. It has, I think, 9,000 verses. And the conversation is a conversation between four birds and Jamini Rishi. The whole Purana goes backwards and forwards with questions and answers, where the four birds speak on behalf of Markandeya Muni. So although he's not very prominent in our Gaudiya line, he's mentioned quite frequently in the Mahabharata, and he's a very classical Vedic, very well-known Vedic sage. And as we know already, his speciality was that he wanted to see how the illusory energy works. I mean, that's a pretty amazing thing, if you think about it for a minute, to see the Lord's illusory energy, because his illusory energy is controlling and bewildering everyone in existence, everyone in this material world, from Lord Shiva all the way down, from Lord Indra all the way down. Everyone, even Lord Brahma, can come very easily under the influence of Krishna's illusory potency. So Markandeya wanted to see that. That's quite extraordinary. That's as if you want to see what's controlling you. So it's very difficult to see what's controlling you, because it's controlling you. But he wanted this. So he had this experience where he lived through these kalpas, because his lifespan, he wasn't eternal, but he lived so many kalpas, maha kalpas, that it was considered that he was as if eternal. Just like the demigods, they live for a mahakalpa, and to, in comparison to ourselves, they also appear eternal. So they're called eternal, immortal, but actually that's because they have a vast, almost inconceivable length of life in this world. So I don't know about you, but I think to myself that long life is not necessarily exciting and something to look forward to. Perhaps if it was required for development spiritually, then a long life is a valuable and a valid asset. But just to live on and on and on, even Sukadeva Goswami didn't think this was a very special thing to be awarded. Because in the second canto he says, don't the trees have long lives? Don't the bellows breathe? He was telling, he was making these points so that we would become disinterested, disinclined to stay on and on in the material world, as if this is the greatest possible thing. And rather, we would tend to wish that we could go beyond what is really eternal, not just long, but actually permanent. Because in that permanent abode, then all our difficulties are actually resolved. They're automatically resolved. And they're unresolvable here, even though we may make so many adjustments. And countless times Srila Prabhupada speaks in his lectures over and over and over and over again, explaining that whatever problems you have, you see in this world, whatever horrible things are happening in this world, whatever difficulties in your life, whatever things you find insurmountable, struggles and so on and so forth, they're nothing. They're like just tiny, tiny, tiny compared to the serious problem that you face. And the serious problem you face comes in the form of birth, death, disease and old age. And for myself, time and time again, I've heard him say this in lectures, I've heard him say it in person, I've read it here and I've read it there. And somehow or another, often I'm not attracted to actually stop and try to understand what he's saying. Perhaps because my mind is on something else, perhaps I don't have the time, but mostly I don't have the inclination. I sort of think, yes, he said that, I heard that, next please. And it doesn't go in, and I don't actually uncover the magnitude of what he's saying. But recently I was sitting in my room listening to Srila Prabhupada, very kind of only half listening, as sometimes happens. And he was giving a comparison that somehow or another opened up my consciousness a little bit. And he was explaining how in this world they make so many aeroplanes. This is the scientist's contribution. And most people, and I would certainly say myself also, we're under the grip of this scientific advancement, either consciously, very consciously, unconsciously, or very unconsciously. We're very much under the grip of the scientific reasoning and their conclusions. And their conclusions are that we're giving you this. We've solved so many diseases. We're making life better. We're giving you this kind of a recorder. We're allowing you to travel throughout the world and see this and see that and have your life enjoyable as much as possible. And not only that, we discount such things as it's obvious that the world is round. Everyone knows the world is round. NASA, everyone. Where would you not think that the world is round? You go upstairs to Srila Prabhupada's room, just here in his house, and there's a nice round atlas on his table. So everybody knows the world is round. And then Srila Prabhupada will say, the world is not round. And then all of our education, our pre-placed theories suddenly become all disturbed. And sometimes the mind will think even, can I trust this person? He says that the world isn't round. He says the moon and the sun are in different places. He says that they never went to the moon. And some people will say, of course they never went to the moon because it's some kind of a hoax. And here's some evidence. And that boosts us a little bit that maybe he's telling the truth. But then he'll land another change of reality upon us, that the mind again will be jolted by it. How can that be? How can that be? I already know this, 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 and this. So I was listening to Srila Prabhupada, and he was explaining the glories of the scientists, that they have created aeroplanes that can fly all around the world. So yes, yes, I accept this. This is not difficult. This is not challenging my view of reality. It is certainly amazing that you get in an aeroplane, you can look out the window, you can watch as the plane takes off and flies high in the air, you can look down, you can see below houses that look like little tiny dots on a computer screen. You can see the pixelation of everything that was once very big around you. You can see this. So you, yes, I can see that. I can accept this. And then he added, but you should understand the greatness of the supreme architect, the supreme scientist, the supreme person, because he has created aeroplanes also. He has created an aeroplane that flies in the sky thousands of miles an hour, and it's equipped with oceans, and it's equipped with countries and skyscraper buildings, and all of humanity is seated on that aeroplane. Now think for a minute, when you walk out of here or when you're sitting here, do you feel that the earth is moving at an extraordinarily rapid rate? Or do you feel that everything is quite stable and you're seated on the marble floor of the Krishna Radha-Ballabha Mandir? Yet it is. It's moving at an incredible rate, the earthly planet. And all the oceans that you fly over in your tiny man-made aeroplanes, they're all resting within this aeroplane that God has made, that Krishna has made. So we need these comparisons as much as possible so that we can start to expand our intelligence, at least a little bit, you know, like if you have some muscle and you don't use it very often, it gets very stiff and rigid. And when you try to move it, it's like really painful and you can only move it a little bit. And you have a strong feeling that let me not move it at all because it's so painful to move it. But then one is told by the doctor, no, you must keep practicing bending, bending, bending until you get the flexibility back again. So similarly in our Krishna consciousness, we have to learn to employ our intelligence to expand itself, to take in, to be receptive, even though it's still so minute, but to become open to Krishna conscious philosophy, to the vision of reality through the eyes of perfected souls who are looking and they can see. Just like if I have eyes and you're all blind, and I might say, in this room right now there are two gentlemen sitting on chairs, and to you there's just darkness. How can you say there are two people sitting on chairs? And the floor has green color in it and streaks of brown. How do they know that? That's amazing. This is how it sounds to one who is blind. So sitting right here, Srila Prabhupada was seated when one devotee, Raghunath Das, an early Prabhupada disciple from Sydney, put his hand up after Srila Prabhupada had explained about various ways to travel, including the fact that there were giant eagles that flew from one planet to another. So this was too much for Raghunath's conceptive power. And he said they're so giant that they hatch their eggs as they're flying, and by falling the centrifugal force allows the egg to hatch and more giant eagles fly. And we can say, oh, I've only seen eagles this big in the zoo. What, how can there be giant eagles? And so Raghunath, who was a little bit, I remember at the time, he was losing his faith a little bit to his rational faculties. So he put up his hand and asked Srila Prabhupada, perhaps with a slight tinge of arrogance, but definitely with the feeling that he should be able to understand things properly. And he asked Srila Prabhupada, and he commented that it was a little hard to believe. And Srila Prabhupada looked down on him. From up there, you look down on people. You look down on him. And his eyes sort of half open, he was seated just there, he said to him, "What do you know?" And everybody fell silent, and then he said, "You are still in the womb of your mother." In the womb of your mother, Srila Prabhupada would take an O. And then his head remained very strongly up, and he looked away from him. "You are still in the womb of your mother." Well, think about that for a minute. How do you feel if someone says that to you? You're still not even born. You still can't even understand anything. You haven't even arrived on this earth yet. You're being carried around in a helpless condition by the kindness of your mother. So the mother is this material nature. And people talk about nature, and the scientists analytically discuss nature, but they don't say that it's Krishna's nature. They discuss it as a separate phenomena, and they can explain how this works like this, and that goes like that, and that goes like this, and so many things. But when you ask them, where did it come from, their answers are so inconclusively cold and unreasonable, actually, that things just somehow, there was a chemical reaction and things came into order. Then we could say, can you go to your laboratory and create a chemical reaction that's going to produce order? It's going to produce the people that are going to keep going and perpetuate this chemical reaction. So Srila Prabhupada says that a clockmaker, he can make a clock. He's very clever. But Krishna can make a clock that makes more clocks and more clocks and more clocks. In other words, human beings can perpetuate their species, the animals perpetuate. And he comments how the Darwinists, he says he thinks he poorly, he didn't fully understand the Padma Purana. And he took some little facts here and there and made up his theory. But the world goes on deep, deep, deep in ignorance, thinking that these things are truths. And they're passed to us, we receive them at a very young age. They go right in and we grab them like little fish are grabbing little pieces of bait that hang dangling down from above. We grab them, we learn them, we memorize them, we pass our exams, we get a job, we go on and on and on and on. We run through our life, still in the womb of the mother. Didn't go anywhere. But we feel, no, I did. Look, here's my degrees, and here's my this, and my that, and my on, and on, and on. Or if I don't have all those things, at least the people who I respect and I get my knowledge from, they have all these things. But we should be very careful in this material world, and we should accept the premise that, yes, we have to live in this world, but we should not be of this world. And some people will say, well, that's very difficult. It's very hard to work in the world and not be of the world. And then we will say, it may be very difficult, but it will be to your advantage if you take up this particular difficulty and take it seriously. Then you can live your life, you can do what you need to do, you can take care of your family, but at the end of life you'll know very well where to focus your intelligence. And you'll be very careful. Yes, this is the path. And this is what Markandeya Muni saw in total. This is the bewildering power of the illusory energy. And it's meticulous. You cannot find, it's seamless. You cannot sort of like say, oh, this is the illusory energy and there's a little gap here and I can see through here, but this actually doesn't make sense. The material energy is so perfect that anyone who's here thoroughly, thoroughly, thoroughly is absorbed in things of here. And this is so nice. Now you might say, after all that criticism, how can you say this is very nice? And this is why it's nice. Just think, if this energy absorbs everyone's attention, like everyone's attention so thoroughly, including our own, imagine what the person who made it is like. If he can make an energy that we don't want to know about him because we like his energy so much. But imagine what he would be like. What an incredible person he would be. But only we have to accept that somebody is in control. And it's not me. And isn't it amazing, because nobody in this room will accept that I'm in control except me. And vice versa for all of you. You'll think, I'm in control, I'm doing very nicely, my life is going just how I want it to be. Difficulties come, that's not a problem for me. I know how to manage my difficulties and everything is going well. When in fact, we're all bewildered by this particular illusion of independence, illusion of control, illusion of well-being. When in fact, we're very, very far away from where we will be happy. So Markandeya saw Lord Shiva suddenly appear within his heart. Lord Shiva's golden hair resembled lightning. And he had 3 eyes, 10 arms, and a tall body that shone like the rising sun. Now, I've never seen anyone with 10 arms, so I'm not sure if I believe this. Right? No. He wore a tiger skin, and he carried a trident, a bow, arrows, a sword, and a shield, along with prayer beads, a damaru drum, a skull, and an axe. He carried an axe. So he's carrying here weapons, he's carrying here beads, he's carrying here a drum, and we know what the drum is for. When he wishes to destroy everything, he just plays that drum, and yeah, the damaru and everything becomes burnt to ashes. Astonished, the sage came out of his trance and thought, who is this and where does this come from? When you first wake up, sometimes even someone you know, you're like, who is this? Oh, and then he gets his bearings. So opening his eyes, the sage saw Lord Rudra, the spiritual master of the three worlds, together with Uma and Rudra's followers. Markandeya then offered his respectful obeisances by bowing his head. When Markandeya Rishi saw Lord Shiva and Uma within his heart, he immediately became aware of them. So he saw them. Remember, he entered into the sky of his consciousness. And in his meditation, he suddenly saw a person appeared. Just like if you were sleeping and you had your eyes closed and all of a sudden you saw in your dream a person appears and they're right in front of you, it would give you a shock. So he suddenly saw him, he became aware of him, and thus also, as soon as he became aware of him, he became aware of himself as well. So this is very interesting, because the impersonalists, just to help us to become, to free ourselves from impersonalism, because impersonalism is a very, very unpleasant thing. It's like having some kind of a plague, or having fleas, or head lice. No one will like you, and you're not very likable if you have scratching your head all the time and the little lice are going on everybody else. And in India, you're like, you see somebody who looks a little scruffy, you stay a bit away because you don't want to have to go through the process of removing the head lice from their head into your hair, and it's very unpalatable. But if you have impersonal tendencies, it's just as unpalatable, because it's so undesirable that we think that the Supreme Person doesn't exist, and we have no respect, no affection for him. Because without affection for him, we honestly cannot have affection for anyone. Because just like without the sunlight, you can't see. You can't see clearly without the sun. So if you can't see because the sun isn't there, you can't see. So this is such an important point. Anything that can remove this impersonalism. So the philosophy of impersonalism is that we all become one. And some people think that they like that philosophy. And they preach it. But they don't understand the implications of that philosophy. They have no idea. They aren't thoughtful enough. So they say, we all become one. So they're continuing to say we. And we means all of us in this room. But to become one means there's only one. It means you don't exist. To perceive oneness, you're no longer present in that oneness. And actually, it's very rare that anyone really wants to non-exist completely. They would prefer to have some peace of mind or some sort of serenity or some vast experience. They want something. They want an experience of oneness. But you can't experience oneness because oneness means one. There's nobody there to experience. This is called annihilation, when you don't exist anymore. So why don't these impersonalists just take a gun and shoot themselves? They won't exist anymore. But they're very, very anxious to exist and to study and analyze the oneness and all of these various theories. And they don't understand. And our acharyas, particularly Śrīla Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he presents elaborate arguments about the absurdity of this impersonalism. And yet, because they have the support of the illusory energy, and here we are stuck in the illusory energy, so they're very powerful. And when they present their arguments, even though we disagree with them and we can see the faultiness of their logic, they still swamp like a huge tsunami the intelligence of all the fools and rascals in this world, because it's an easy philosophy. Śrīla Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, why is it so popular? Well, it is a little bit like water. We were hearing in the retreat about how King Indra, he killed his Guru Vishwarup, and he got a reaction for that. So he decided that, just like, say, if I get some sort of a bill from some company and they give me a huge bill for something and I don't want to pay all that money out, I can ask my friends, hey, listen, I'll do this for you, and in exchange for me doing this for you, can you give me some money? And they give some money, and then they all pay it together. We all pay it together and they get something. So in that way, one of the payouts that King Indra performed was he benedicted water to have the potency to whatever you add water to, it will expand that particular liquid. If you have orange juice and you put water in, you'll have more orange juice. You won't have orange juice at the top and water at the bottom. It will synthesize together and create more of the original liquid. So this is a special quality of water. So the special quality of impersonalism is like that, that it can go with anything. Because it's impersonal, it has no characteristic like that. So I can worship animals and I can incorporate that into Advaitavad. Or I can worship idols and I can say, this is everything, anything, whatever you do, it's all right, because ultimately in the end it's nothing anyway, so what's the problem? So you can do this, you can do that, you can have a sensually perverted religious process, and that also can be compatible with Mayavad, impersonal path. So like the water can expand anything, the impersonal path just allows any rubbish to become rampantly increasing. So we should be very alert to the presence of impersonal philosophy, especially impersonalism and materialism, pretty much back to back. That's kind of our problem, because we don't mind a little materialism, but we don't understand that the backside of that, like the light and the dark, is the impersonalism also comes along. So here, Markandeya is in his trance, and as if like an impersonalist, he's not aware of anything. He's not even aware of himself. He's so deeply focused. And we hear that even Vaishnavas, even exalted devotees, even like up to the level of the most greatest, the most famous devotees in all of creation, the gopis in Vrindavan, and up to the highest of the gopis, Srimati Radharani, who of course is not technically a devotee in the sense that she is in that category, Jiva Tattva, but she, at her highest level of love, Radha and Krishna forget themselves, and they merge into an incredible amount of loving ecstasy. But this is a different kind of merging. They merge into love. They submerge into love. So this is what a Vaishnava's path is directing you towards. And if you go on this path, you will achieve something that's unattainable by anyone else. And it may be difficult. And the reason it's difficult is because it's superior. If you want the most expensive, you want to get married and you want the most expensive ring for your wife to be, it's going to be more expensive. It's the most expensive. It's going to be more expensive. How can you logically think I want the most expensive and it should be cheapest? Again, you see, we have all these foolish things going on in our head that when we become aware of them, we realize that's really stupid. But this is how we think. I want this, but I don't want to put up the trouble. It's too much trouble. Why should it be so much trouble? But I want this. But this costs so much money, Baba. You know, you have to pay for it. Everything you have to pay for. What to speak of the superior, supermost thing? So we should take that trouble and we should follow the example of these great personalities and we should be eager to make advancement on this particular path. So Markandeya, who was not aware of himself, he had simply been absorbed in awareness of the Supreme Lord and had thus forgotten himself as the conscious perceiver. He had forgotten about himself. Now the material mind will never let us do that. You should notice. Again, as an observer, you will notice that you never forget about yourself. Occasionally you get very happy and you may sort of feel so happy that you don't have to be calculatingly thinking. You can relax for a moment, but you will not forget yourself as long as you have a material mind and a materialistic intelligence. So Markandeya worshipped Lord Shiva along with Uma and Shiva's associates by offering them words of welcome, sitting places, water for washing their feet, scented drinking water, fragrant oils, flower garlands and arti lamps. It's interesting that he had all these things available. Perhaps he had some mystic powers as well. Markandeya said, "O mighty Lord, what can I possibly do for you who are fully satisfied by your own ecstasy? Indeed, by your mercy, you satisfy this entire world." The word is nirvritam, and is translated as is made peaceful. Jagat nirvritam. So the whole world can be made peaceful by Lord Shiva's blessings. So what is our relationship with Lord Shiva? What do we seek from Lord Shiva? I assume that many of you have visited Rudradweep. Hands up anyone who has been to Rudradweep. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, all the rest of our assembled devotees are so fortunate because you have the opportunity to visit Rudradweep for the first time. Rudradweep is one of the islands of Navadweep Dham. And if you go down the road from the Krishna Balaram Mandir past the Yoga Pit, the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and then you turn the other way, turn left, you take a few different roads through the beautiful rural countryside of Navadweep Dham, and you come across a canal and you go through some villages where the people are very friendly, and you eventually arrive by the bank of the Ganga. Actually now, perhaps I have not been recently, perhaps now the Ganga is far away from Rudradweep. But in the 90s, 1995, 1996, some time ago when I visited there, the Ganga was coming closer and closer and closer and cutting the bank and cutting the bank and cutting the bank. And I remember going there and the pujaris in the temple, there was a temple, and they were looking and the Ganga was maybe there where the steps are and still coming, cutting, 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 and the sand would just crumble as it went into the Ganga. And I remember saying to the pujaris, what will you do? It's like so close, the temple's here and the Ganga's there. And they said, well, she's just coming to take darshan of mm-hmm. Lord Shiva. And everything will be all right. She will take darshan. And then I came some years later and the temple was under the Ganga. And Lord Shiva had moved further into the fields and they had built a nice ashram. But that's a very nice place. There's a deity there of Lord Shiva. And it's a place that one goes as one of the places in a Navadvip Parikrama. But it's also a very, very nice place to go just, if you're in Navadvip, just to go there for the day and sit there in the presence of Lord Shiva at his Rudradvip Rudra Bhavan. There also there is a deities of Radha, Krishna and Lord Chaitanya. I believe that were installed by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur himself, carried them there from the Yogapit. So Lord Shiva, he's very kindly towards us. He's happy to see that we're trying to become obedient. He's happy to see us trying to serve. And so he also can bring peace to us. We can pray to Lord Shiva for his blessings. And I remember going to that place, and it was very easy to sit there in front of Lord Shiva and pray that, please, kindly release me. Release me, if at all possible. Release me from the grip of this illusory energy that Markandeya Rishi has had a chance to see in its entirety. Of course, not in its entirety, because he's only one small soul, but he's had a chance to heavily experience. We experience it only life after life after life in a small time, kind of encapsulated way. But please, if you would be so kind, help me to take my concentration and my focus away from trying to enjoy this matter, this material world, and help me to please surrender to the lotus feet of Sri Sri Gaura Nittai, Sri Sri Radha Vallabha, and Sri Sri Jagannath Subhadra and Baladev. And in this way, my life will become fruitful. And the purpose of all of this elaborate arrangement of material creation and annihilation and this thing and that thing and all the various faculties and demigods and controllers and everything, the purpose of that will have been achieved by me. Insofar as I will understand there's nothing for me here, and I will proceed onwards towards the supreme destination of Krishna's service in the spiritual realm, which is our home and where we belong. So I'll stop here. If anyone has any questions, please raise them. Yes, Mahatma.
One comment from scientist theory. Now they're talking about stem cells.
Talking about?
Stem cells. They can cure cancer, they can cure everything.
Yes.
They're making something to
give. It's wonderful. It's wonderful.
Would you like to hear something about Mukunda Datta?
Me?
Mukunda Datta.
Mukunda Datta?
Yes.
Mukunda Datta's appearance day today?
Yes.
Mukunda Datta. Mukunda Datta and Vasudev Datta, they came from East Bengal. What's the name of the place now? Among Chattogram. Pundarik Dham. Mm-hmm. And they were brothers. Vasudev Datta, the older one, was extremely magnanimous. He was so generous in giving that he never had anything. He was just giving and giving. And as we know, Vasudev, when Lord Chaitanya asked him for what he wanted, he said that he wanted that everyone in the world, in the universe, could be liberated, and he would take all the suffering for them. If they had any bad karma or anything, let him suffer all of that and let them become free. So this was Vasudev, the older of the Dattas, and Lord Chaitanya placed him under the care of Shivananda Sen, because Shivananda Sen was an expert manager of money and everything else. So he said, you please take care of Vasudev. Mukunda Datta was contemporary age to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He studied with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And there's one little story in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, how whenever Lord Chaitanya would see Mukunda, He would stop him, like if he's walking into the temple, Chaitanya would walk the other way and come and confront him. And Mukunda would be there, and Lord Chaitanya at this time was in the mood of a scholar, and he would ask him some Sanskrit rhetorical question. And Mukunda, he didn't really want to do that. It was like as if somebody always wanted to ask you riddles, you know, and then and you're like, oh. And so he would ask him, what is the verb root of this and this and this? And Mukunda would try to answer, and whatever he would say, Lord Chaitanya would laugh at him and call and say, Mukunda thinks he knows so much, but I know so much more than Mukunda. And he would make jokes at Mukunda's expense. So Mukunda, one time he was coming on the road and Lord Chaitanya was coming with his followers, and Mukunda saw him coming in the distance, and he very quickly went down a side street so that they wouldn't meet. And Lord Chaitanya, Nimai Pandit, he saw this and he laughed and laughed, and he said to his friends, look at Mukunda, he sees me coming and he's running away from me. And then he said, he thinks that he's some sort of a Vaishnava, that you know, he doesn't want to engage in my materialistic wrangling of this and that and this and that. And then he turned to his friends and he said, one day I will show Mukunda. I will become such a Vaishnava myself that everyone will worship me. And then everyone laughed and they went on. So Lord Chaitanya was very pleased with Mukunda because he understood that Mukunda didn't want to waste his time in this Sanskrit wrangling business. And then later, when Lord Chaitanya showed his Mahaprakash, he revealed to all the devotees that he wasn't only an expert, exalted Vaishnava, servant of all the devotees, but that he was actually the Supreme Lord himself. And he sat down in a trance on the asana, on the altar of Srivas Pandit, and called for all the devotees to come, and he would give them benedictions. And so when Mukunda was to come, he didn't call for Mukunda. And then when Advaitacharya said, what about Mukunda? Mukunda would come. He said, Mukunda, tell Mukunda he can't come. He said, I don't want to see Mukunda. Mukunda associates with impersonalists. Because Mukunda had done some study of some sort in some type of Sanskrit. I don't know the actual details. So then Mukunda was outside. And he heard this, that Lord Chaitanya in this exalted transcendental state of ecstasy did not want to see him. And then one of the devotees, I think Advaitacharya again, said, well, when will you see Mukunda? And he said, I won't see Mukunda for millions of births. After millions of births, I will see Mukunda. And Mukunda outside, he started to cry and he started dancing, but he was no longer crying in sadness, he was so happy. And he said, he will see me after millions of births. He's willing to see me after millions of births. And he became so happy that he was going to see him again after millions of births. And when Lord Chaitanya saw the depth of Mukunda's love in this example, that what he had displayed, then he said, bring Mukunda immediately. So Mukunda came in and he was crying, and Lord Chaitanya chastised him, and Mukunda was crying and crying and bowed down. So this is Mukunda, and Mukunda was a wonderful singer. He could play different musical instruments, and when he would sing, all the Vaishnavas assembled would just go into a kind of a trance, and they would cry, and some of them would roll on the ground just hearing him sing the glories of the Lord. And one time Ishwara Puri came to Navadvipa, and he was going here and there to different places, and he came into the place where Mukunda was singing, and nobody knew him. They didn't know who he was. He was a sannyasi, but nobody knew his particulars. And when he heard Mukunda sing, Ishwara Puri went into such a deep state of transcendental ecstasy, rolling on the ground, crying and weeping. So we can't imagine rolling on the ground and crying and weeping at Mangalati, you know. we don't do that, you know. We just come and we put ourselves through the sadhana practice, and our mind wanders around here and there, and we think of other things and we do our activities. So it's a little inconceivable. It almost sounds a little bit kind of meaningless, people rolling on the ground and crying, weeping. But at least we can understand that they must have a lot of feeling to be crying, because sometimes we cry and we have a lot of feeling. So that this was Mukunda. And today also is the appearance day, I think, of Shamananda Pandit, who's another exalted follower of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. After Lord Chaitanya disappeared, the next followers, of course, were who? The next prominent level of the parampara? No, the next was the six Goswamis, Rupa Sanatan, and then after Rupa and Sanatan, then Raghunath Das, Raghunath Bhatta, Gopal Bhatta and Jiva Goswami were all younger, so they all followed. And Shijiva Goswami was the very youngest of all. So Jiva Goswami became the Vaishnava Acharya in Vrindavan after the time of Rupa and Sanatan. And at that time in Bengal, people did not have access to the writings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which were written down by Rupa and Sanatan. And of course later Jiva Goswami wrote so many books. So they had no access to this. So they had, you could say, the pieces of the puzzle were that in Bengal they had the Sankirtan, and that was their offering of glory. And in Vrindavan they were writing. All the Shastras were written in Vrindavan. So Srinivasacharya came from Bengal and he became a student under Sri Jiva Goswami. And soon after he had been studying in Vrindavan, he began to think to himself. He found in his mind the word Narottam kept coming into his mind. And he didn't know why this word kept coming to him. Narottam, Narottam. And very soon after that, Narottam Das arrived in Vrindavan and became his co-student under Sri Jiva Goswami's tutelage. And after some time longer, Shamananda Pandit came. And he was from Orissa. He was born, his father was a Brahmana. He had six daughters, or not six, but many daughters, and they all died. And so when he was born, his father, to hoping that perhaps he would not die, he called him Dukhi, which means kind of like miserable, sad. Like in India when they put the big black bindi on the child, so that if they're very beautiful, you won't become envious of them. You'll look at the big black spot on their face and you'll just leave your gaze on the black. It's imperfect, not looking so much special. And you won't become envious of what they do have. So in the same way, by calling him Dukhi, it was like a bit pessimistic, like, please let him stay. He's not very important. Please keep him. So he grew up in Orissa. And then he became very saintly at a young age. He went and took his initiation from Hridayananda, Hriday Chaitanya, whose stapit is, his sripat is in Navadvip, across from the Mayapur, in, what's the place, Ambika Kalna. And he was initiated there, and then he came also to Vrindavan. So these three, Shamananda, Srinivas and Narottam, became inseparable. And they brought some comfort to the hearts of the Vaishnavas. Just imagine, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had left. We can't imagine. But all the Vaishnavas, who are his eternal associates also, they're all in deep, deep feelings of separation. And none of them want to be in this world anymore. And many of them are already half in trance all the time. And when you go to see them, they're just crying and crying. No longer eating, no longer sleeping. Just waiting to go and join Chaitanya Mahaprabhu somewhere else. And so everybody who sees them feels also this bloom. But it's a transcendental mood of separation. But it doesn't feel very transcendental, because it's a sense of loss. And then these three young Vaishnavas appear in their midst. And so everyone bestowed their love and their blessings upon them and wished them well, that they may do something wonderful, because they wanted to leave and join Lord Chaitanya. And so these three were commissioned by Srila Jiva Goswami to take in a sealed box, very carefully prepared box, very big box, some say the original literatures written by Rupa Sanatana and Jiva Goswami. Some say they were copies, but they were to take this literature from Vrindavan to Bengal, where the people were so anxious to receive it. And so on an auspicious day, they all walked behind these carts with first-class bullocks and these three young Vaishnavas, and they walked all the assembled Vaishnavas from Vrindavan, all in great procession, went all the way to Mathura. And from Mathura, with Sri Jiva Goswami as the presiding head of this procession, they farewelled these three Vaishnavas on their journey, walking all the way back to Bengal. And everything went very nicely for them. They went through various provinces and various places without any difficulty until they arrived very close to their destination, actually, in a place that you can visit to this day. It's called Vishnupur, Van Vishnupur. It's in Bengal, not so far from Navadvip. When they got there, they came to a place where there was a king, and he was a dacoit. Yes. And he employed astrologers to be able to sort of predict if anyone was coming into his kingdom. They could tell if someone was coming today that would have wealth, someone was coming, they had this ability to plan and what was taking place, to see, and then the king would hijack it, whatever was coming through his kingdom. So the astrologers told him that someone with inestimable wealth is coming. Inestimable. You couldn't even begin to understand how valuable what these three men were carrying. And so he sent spies, and the spies followed them and watched them and tried to see what they were doing. And at night they'd peacefully sleep, and there had never been any trouble, so the bullock cart would be there and they'd sleep, and in the morning they would continue. And when they came very close to the township of Van Vishnupur, in the evening, the men of the king went and they kidnapped the bullock cart and the box of all the shastra and everything and took it to the king. And the king, when he received it, he put it down in his room, this box. He was like looking at it. In here is the most valuable thing you could ever, ever, ever imagine. He's looking at the box and looking, and finally he had them undo the box, and they undid the box all around, and they lifted off the top and they laid back all the cloth which the shastras were wrapped in, and he saw it. It's religious books. My goodness. And then he realized, now I'm really in trouble. I've stolen these religious books and given these sadhus all this difficulty. Now I'm going to be really, my whole life is ruined because of this. And as he looked at the pages of the books, he had tears coming down from his eyes, and his heart totally changed. And then he just wanted to meet the people who were carrying these books. And so then at that particular time, when they woke up, Shamananda, Srinivas and Narottam, they were so disturbed that the books had been stolen, they decided right then they would all commit suicide. But Srinivas said, no, I have a feeling I think I know what to do here. So he told Shamananda, you go back to Utkal to Orissa and preach, and Narottam, you go back to Bengal to Kettari Dham and preach, and I will recover these books. And he did. He recovered the books, and he converted that king, Virhambir was his name. He converted him into a great, 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 great Vaishnava, and that kingdom became a wonderful Vaishnava kingdom. And to this day, if you look even on the internet, you can see there's beautiful temple architecture there, like nowhere else in Bengal. And the samadhi of that king Virambir is in the Radha Damodar courtyard. So just see, from that he came to there. And he became a great exalted Vaishnava by the mercy of these personalities. So Srinivasa, Shamananda Pandit, he preached in Orissa. He had many, many disciples. He made many people Vaishnavas. His Sripat, which means like his place, the place where he is most accessible, just like Srila Prabhupada is most accessible in Sri Krishna Balaram Mandir at the Samadhi there. So his Sripat is in Gopibalavpur. Gopibalavpur is on the Suvarnarekha River, just on the border of Bengal and Orissa. And so his family have, the family coming from Rasikananda and his family have managed there for many generations. And Actually, it's the dynasty coming from Rasikanand, but he's one of the main disciples of Shyamananda Pandit. And Shyamananda Pandit's samadhi, I think, is in Vrindavan, Pushpa Samadhi. And the temple that is in his family line is, of course, Radhashyama Sunda Temple. And if you go and see Radhashyama Sunda there, my goodness, he has eyebrows, and chandan on his eyebrows, on his eyelids, is just extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the most attractive temples in Vrindavan, one of the most vibrant temples. And I remember many, many years ago now, in the 80s, in the late 80s, going to see Radhashyama Sunda, and he had this wonderful crown. I'd never seen anything like it. It's one piece like this, like a hat, round like this, and then it has a big mukut on the top, and the mukut goes right over to the side. And I went to the Radhashyama Sunda temple and saw this crown, and I thought, that's so nice. If our Radhashyama Sunda could have a crown like that, it would be so nice. So I went to the mukut shop, the silver wala, and I said to him, can you make a crown just like Radhashyama Sunda's in the temple for our Radhashyama Sunda? And he said, oh, that will be very difficult. And so then, but he did some Vrindavan schemes, as they can do in Vrindavan, and he called me up and he said, we have to go at 9 o'clock at night to the Radhashyama Sunda temple, you and I. As soon as the temple is closed and there's nobody there and it's dark and everything is completely shut down, we go there together. And the pujari, I don't know if he must have bribed him, the pujari is willing for us to put a piece of tracing paper and some crayon over the top of the crown and trace all the design onto a piece of tracing paper. So we went, and it was so exciting. Dark, no one was around. Got inside, and the pujari was there. He was a bit nervous, you know, because he was doing this very dishonest but wonderful act. And he brought out the crown, and we copied it. And I said to the silversmith, now, can you make that exactly? And he said, yes, yes, yes. And so then the pujari says, so? And we said, well, what does he want? So they talked back and forth, and the pujari said he wanted a very long silver flute for Radhashyama Sunda in the temple. So then after that, many years passed, and it was assumed that, by me at least, and others, that that flute had been made and given to Radhashyama Sunda. And then I think it was in the early 90s, somehow or another, it came to my knowledge that he had never received his flute. And Pujari had some ill will towards us for never giving him his flute. So then I went to the silversmith, and we worked out how to make him an extraordinarily beautiful, long, large silver flute. And on the Sharad Purnima, the first day of Kartik, when all the deities wear white, we took that flute and we went to see Radhashyama Sunda, and we gave him this beautiful flute. And then the Pujari was satisfied. So, always have a connection with Shyamananda Pandit, because he is worshipping Radhashyama Sunda and we are worshipping Radhashyama Sunda. And Radhashyama Sunda have a beautiful crown, just like. And to this day, they still wear that, usually on Ekadasi. So if you see them wearing it straight around here and right to the side like that, you'll know that that's coming from Radhashyama Sunda's mercy and Shyamananda Pandit's blessings. Okay, thank you.